It's 11 past 8 Central African time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Radio Islam International this Sunday evening. And great to be with you for another edition of Under the Radar. We're with you until 10 p.m. tonight. And what we're going to be looking at during the course of this first hour is the attack on Salman Rushdie that occurred in New York on Friday, and putting that in historical perspective in just a bit. We also go over to Istanbul and Turkey, where we speak to Bilal Basyuni, who's attending a major Middle Eastern youth conference hosted by the Al-Sharq Forum. We'll get a tip into the kind of discussions that are occurring amongst the young people of the Arab and Islamic worlds. In the second hour of the show, we continue a bit of a historical focus on the current story relating to the book, The Satanic Verses, and Salman Rushdie, how it played out, and some of the responses that had occurred in the late 1980s. We'll also get an update or some perspective 1 week after the latest Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip, and also some internal information on how some Twitter employees were caught spying on some users of Twitter on behalf of regimes in the Middle East, in this case the Saudi regime. We start off this evening by just talking about the update relating to Salman Rushdie. After this attack on Friday, he was taken off a ventilator. He's now able to talk after the stabbing that had occurred at the onset of a lecture in the New York State. The 75-year-old Rushdie is still hospitalized with serious injuries, but some reports from agents and people close to him say that he may be off a ventilator and is talking. He's off the ventilator, said an agent for the author, and he is, according to him, on a road, a long road to recovery, which the agent says will be long and with severe injuries, but he claims that he's headed in the right direction. On Saturday, that was yesterday, the man accused of attacking him at that speech on Friday pleaded not guilty to the attack or attempted murder, and he was brought to court on charges of a pre-planned crime. His name is Hadi Matar, and he entered the plea on his behalf. A lawyer for him entered a plea on his behalf during the arraignment in West New York. So that's a kind of update on the situation thus far. But I always find with such stories, if a person has lived through that moment, they would understand and see this in an entirely different light. People have just read about it, people have just heard about it, perhaps in the decades gone by, might not be able to see the story in its full context, not having experienced the emotions and the debates of the time. And that's why this evening I bring on Professor Suleiman Dengo, who's emeritus professor at the University of KwaZulu Natal, to share with us some of the historical texture to the story, the debates that were occurring at that time, the protests, the emotions of the moment, and how this was also reflected within South Africa and the South African Muslim community. Professor, good to have you on board. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me on your show.
And absolute pleasure, and no one better than you, Professor, to dig into the troves of memory and bring it out to us this evening. I want to start off with just the synopsis of the story. What's your recollection of when this book was released, and the first time it registered, if you'd like, on people's radar in terms of the offensivity and obviously the toxicity of this book?
Yeah, okay. Rushdie's second book called Midnight Children, that was published in 1981, became very, very popular, won the Booker Prize. So Rushdie already made his mark after his second novel. But then in 1988, he published The Satanic Verses. That was his fourth novel. And of course, that's the one became highly controversial throughout the Muslim world. Because although he claimed that, this was not it was fantasy, not real, and so on and so on. But the point is, he mentions people's names who can easily identify with the wives of the Prophet, the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, or the Prophet himself, whom he calls Mahound, and so on. And of course, historical facts, although he claims that this is fiction, this quite clearly he was referring to actual historical issues, and he was treating the Quran as if he was critiquing Shakespeare's or one of the writer's works. And that's how he actually approached it. So this created a huge storm, obviously, because the Prophet was insulted, the Sahaba was insulted, his wives were insulted, and so on. And also, he made allegations which obviously were untrue. The satanic verses actually refers to ayahs. You know, there's a mention in the Quran where the shaitan was trying to get Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam to get some of the ayahs, it says, to be included. And obviously, they could not be included. So he's referring to those particular verses, and of course, alleging that they were introduced by the Prophet into the Quran, and later on he removed them, and so on. So that's where the whole title comes from. So that's 1988 when the whole controversy started. So what happened is a year later, Ayatollah Khomeini then, that was 1989, issued a fatwa that, Rushdie was guilty of blasphemy and that he should be put to death. Now, we know that not everyone agreed. I know the Egyptian Shaykh said he should be given a chance to repent, and if he repented, he could be forgiven. If not, he could be imprisoned, and so on. So there were, difference of opinion how Rushdie should be penalized. But Khomeini's fatwa was there, and that fatwa, was actually later on reaffirmed. So, the fatwa actually remains. It has not been rescinded. And then also there was a bounty on Salman Rushdie's head, and that's why he had to go into hiding. He needed police protection when he was in the UK. So why did this person called Hadi Matal actually attack him? We're not quite sure yet. One possibility people are suggesting is that maybe, he's after the bounty. So there's a bounty on his head. So we're not quite sure because things are quite unclear at the moment. So I think that's the background to what happened there.
We talk today, Professor, about some of the ideological challenges that Muslims are grappling with. We had a slew of issues that came out of the so-called war on terror. We had Islamophobia. Islamophobia still being a buzzword and challenging the other challenges coming from liberalism and so forth. At that particular time, what was the context to this work? Was it in line with some of the challenges and the onslaughts on Muslims at that particular time, or did this introduce a whole new chapter, a whole new style of attacks on Muslims?
Well, remember, we're talking about 1988, so this was after the Iranian Revolution, so there was a lot of hostility from Western nations towards the Iranian revolution, towards Khomeini himself. And then, Khomeini used to make all these statements about America, the big Satan. So there was a lot of, animosity that was built up during that time. So that's the context. So 1988, it's still into the heart of the revolution. So Rushdie, that's the context in which Rushdie wrote this, but of course he's very critical of Pakistan, and he actually prefers India over Pakistan. So he wrote one of his novels talking about what was actually happening in Pakistan. So obviously the Pakistanis are also very angry with him, So apart from the Muslim world. And so what happened is that people became violent even, you know, they attacked publishers and people who were associated with the book, with the publication. They firebombed some bookshops. And apparently a few people died, you know, during the violence and so on. Some of them were injured. So, you know, it became a very violent protest. Afterwards it subsided, but now we see that this particular individual, for some reason or another, decided to take action. Yeah. So I think that's the context. So there was the issue of the Iranian revolution, which is still fresh in the minds of people.
We also find, you know, the general, you know, talks that were given at that point, and people who had read the book. I'm not sure if you, you know, did undertake the endeavor to read the book, but it just comes out as extremely vulgar and profane. But we also have the fact that this book seems to have been, you know, quite vulgar towards other religions, other religious figures, other even politicians at the time. How would you explain to us, if you've had some background in the book, you know, how does that locate, how do Muslims locate within perhaps all the other kind of you know, insults that were leveled or used under the pretext of fictional license in the book?
Talking about Rushdie's book?
Yes.
Yeah, no, remember, Rushdie is an atheist. And, you know, he has no respect for any religion or any religious figure. And he made it very clear that he's an atheist. And as a writer, you know, they talk about freedom of expression. So as far as he's concerned, he's simply using his right to freedom of expression. And nobody has the right to stop him. And so that's the you know, that's his whole approach. And so what's happening there, he's got a lot of support from writers throughout the world who believe that there should be no restriction. I remember the whole Charlie Hebdo incident, right? So Rushdie supported, you know, the publication of those cartoons, because to him, this was an example of freedom of expression. Nobody has a right to stop anyone from writing what they believe. And so he also believed that the Quran itself and all so-called divine scriptures, you know, they're not beyond criticism. So that's his approach. So even, let us say, the revered figures or sacred figures of other religions, to him, all of them are open to criticism. He has no respect for anyone, not for any personality. Because basically he believes that it's all fiction. He says he believes religion is fiction. You know, it's not something that is revealed, something that is divine. He actually says that, you know, this is something that human beings actually, you know, developed. And so, you know, it's not absolute, and people have a right to condemn it, to criticize it, and so on. So he comes from that particular, he's not the only one, of course. There are many writers, other writers who take that position. So what's going to happen now, he's going to get lots of support from people who, you know, who demand freedom to, it's what they call it, freedom to offend. Freedom to offend. So not only to criticize, but they believe that they have a right to freedom to offend.
Now, we're going to, you know, focus on how this saga played out in South Africa in just a short while. I just want to ask you one more thing in terms of the context here. As an author, you know, one is these semi-gods that are put forward of freedom of expression, the freedom to insult that you spoke about. But I do recall a piece not too long ago by, I think, Hamid Dabashi, professor, where he speaks about Rushdie as, you know, a writer and author in service of empire. And did you get that feeling as well through the satanic verses or any of his other endeavors that particular time? It wasn't just, serving the interests of himself or a group of authors or people who would share this idea of freedom of expression. It also served a bigger purpose in terms of the timing and the targeting.
Yeah, you see, Rushdie then went to settle in the UK. He was protected. He was given police protection and so on. So, this state sometimes make use of individuals to promote their agenda. So it would not be surprising if there's evidence that it was actually supported and maybe even instigated to actually go ahead. In other words, encourage, maybe, not influence his writing, but actually encouraged to go ahead because British themselves had issues with the Muslim world, with Pakistan, for instance, and the Muslim world in general. So Rushdie could be a very useful tool in the imperialist agenda. That's quite possible, yes.
Now, how does this play out in South Africa? I mean, I was listening earlier to a talk that was given by the late Sheikh Ahmed Tidat in the UK, and some reference there to South African Muslims acting very quickly to get this book banned in South Africa. Any other ways that it reflected here in South Africa and the emotions and the responses from Muslim leadership at the time?
Yes, what actually happened is there was going to be a book fair, and they were going to invite Rushdie to the book fair. And one of the people they actually approached was Mohammed Dangle, who was became ambassador to Syria and Libya. But what he wanted to do, I think Nadine Gordimer was involved as well. The people who were organizing the book fair didn't want to take the responsibility of protecting Rushdie, because they knew there was a great deal of anger in South Africa, yeah. And so they were quite concerned about what would happen. So I think they approached Mohammed and said, okay, we call Rushdie here. Can you guarantee us protection? And Mohammed said, how do you expect me to guarantee your protection? I mean, I don't know. Some individual may just get up in the crowd and decide to shoot or whatever. I've got no control. So if you want to invite him, then you take the responsibility. You provide the protection, but don't ask me to do it. I'm not responsible. And so they canceled it. So they didn't invite him. So I think after this thing, government was then approached and informed that this is going to create a serious disturbance in the country. And of course, as you know, at that time also Muslims were playing quite a prominent role in politics, very highly regarded individuals. And I think government took note of that and decided, look, we don't want to have serious repercussions in this country by allowing him to come down. So the book was actually banned in South Africa. It was banned in many, many countries, including in India, by the way. And of course, in Muslim countries, Iran, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sudan, Indonesia, Singapore, of course, and also it was banned in places like Thailand and Sri Lanka, and of course then in South Africa itself. So, yeah, that's the story of Rushdie. Now, we don't know what's going to happen from here onwards. It'll be quite interesting to see how the story develops.
Indeed, there's an interesting excerpt here just for the historical, people's historical interest in the Washington Post archives. It talks about, when his visit was called off, Fatima Amir. It says one of the country's leading sociologists and prominent figure in the anti-apartheid movement walked out of a Weekly Mail seminar in Cape Town Monday night because she said she's against Rushdie's scheduled appearances during the planned book festival. Mir, it says, who is Muslim of Indian descent, said that while she supports Rushdie's right to express his political views publicly, she cannot condone the content of his latest novel. So that's from the Washington Post, way back from the archives, 1988, November the 3rd. Finally, beyond the pressure that was brought to stop his visit to South Africa, getting his book censored, do you recall, Professor, any other public events, public talks in South Africa, protests, anything of that sort from the Muslim community at that stage?
Well, the Muslim community, yes, obviously you hear them on radio. I can't remember. So they have discussions. I think the masjid platforms were used. Ulama spoke out against the book. And I'm not sure which radio stations at the time were still on. I'm not sure if any Muslim radio stations were there. So, but I think I recall writing an article at some stage about Rushdie. I can't remember where it was published, but I did certainly write an article about Rushdie. And I also, yes, I discussed it at the university in my class when we were talking about freedom of expression and so on. So I did refer to this particular one. But the fact is that there is nothing as absolute freedom of expression. Everybody claims it, but there is no such thing. Even the person who demands freedom of expression, if you push him, and say, for instance, simple matter, so will you be okay if somebody gets up on a public platform and accuses your mother of prostitution and you know she's innocent, how will you respond? And immediately you'll see the reaction. So there is no such thing as absolute freedom. Freedom has to come with responsibility. And this is what Islam teaches us. And in fact, every constitution you look in the world, they always have a clause talking about deformation of character, including our own constitution. So, and of course, we also have issues like hate speech. So in other words, expression is conditional. It is limited by certain things like not causing offense, and so on. And of course, we just saw this episode in Cape Town now, by the way, where the statements were made, and of course, the reaction has come here is primarily because it has caused offense to a sect of the Muslims. So there is no, there is no absolute right to freedom of expression. And I think this is what's at the heart of the whole story of Salman Rushdie.
Just before you go, Professor, I see a question coming in here. Do you know if this book it's a different dispensation altogether, but if this book still remains banned in South Africa?
Oh, I wouldn't know that. I don't know. Really, I must be quite honest with you. I don't know.
All right, that's probably an interesting one to look up, but obviously time has moved on and people's ways of accessing information have also evolved drastically in the 3 decades since then. But I thank you so much, Professor, for that historical perspective to be able to understand the developments that have played out since Friday in the United States of America with the stabbing of Salman Rushdie. We'll share some audio of Sheikh Ahmed Tira talking about the same topic a bit later on in the second hour. But for now, thank you so much for your time. Shukran and assalamu alaikum.
Okay, and I want to thank you for reminding me about Fatima Mir. It slipped my mind completely, yes. And that's the particular, I think, the book fair that they were planning to invite Rushdie to. Shukran. Jazakumullah. Assalamu alaikum.
Barakallahu fiqh. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.